From KUOW Seattle, this is The Record with Ross Reynolds. I'm Marcy Silman. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is never out of the headlines for long. From the government's response to Nelson Mandela's memorial to Prime Minister Netanyahu's dire warnings about possible consequences of Western detente with Iran, we hear about it, we read about it every day. Israeli journalist Ari Shavit examines the psyche of his nation, as well as the roots of the contemporary relationship between Israelis and Palestinians in his new book. It's called My Promised Land. It's part memoir, part history, part reporter's notebook. Ari Shavit, thanks for taking time to meet with to talk with me today.
Pleasure to be with you, Marcy.
How old were you when you first became conscious of the divide between Jews and Arabs in Israel?
The first thing I was aware of was fear. Now that Israel is perceived to be so strong, I'm not quite sure it is. People forget how fragile it basically was. So when I grew up, my first notion was a notion of fear. It was only many years later, when I was a soldier, that I became aware of occupation and of the suffering of the Palestinians. So these two notions of fear and the awareness to intimidation on the one hand, and then the growing awareness to occupation and to the injustice or wrongdoing done to the Palestinians as well, are the two strongest feelings that evolved over the years.
Was it fear of Arabs or fear of some sort of violence that was going to be perpetrated against you personally?
Well, me as a Jew, as an Israeli Jew, let us remember that our Arab neighbors in the 1960s officially wanted to throw us into the sea. This was no joke. And when there was, it was only because Israel became stronger over the years that we overcame that fear. But the basic notion that our neighbors do not want us alive, definitely do not want a sovereign Jewish state, but perhaps even don't want the Jews alive in that country, that was a deep feeling, and it was not an unfounded one.
This book, as I mentioned, it's not really a history, but you do start historically. You tell a story chronologically, beginning with your own great-grandfather, I believe, who was a Zionist. And I wanted you to explain the definition of that word, Zionism, for people who don't know what that means.
First of all, let me say something about the book. The book is really, as you just say, it's about history, but it's not a history book. It's relevant to politics. It's not a political book. It's an attempt to bring the conflict of that land and the story of my people back to the human level. And in this sense, perhaps there is a new genre here. And I really wanted it to be a story, not an argument, not a theory, not polemics. I wanted the narrative back. That's what I tried to do in the book. And many people tell me that it's nonfiction that reads like fiction. And that's a compliment for me. That's what I tried to do. Talking about Zionism, Zionism at the heart of it is the movement that was designed and is designed to save the Jewish people. In this country, when Jews as individuals are doing so well and as a community, people sometimes forget where the Jews have been 100 years ago and 150 years ago. The Jews were an endangered species, and my claim is that in many ways they still are. Zionism is a movement to save Jewish existence. There are two facets to that. One is the physical one. This was a movement that came to build a home to a homeless people that was the most persecuted people in the West at that time. The other dimension of it is that it came to save non-ultra-Orthodox Jewish civilization. The claim of the Zionists, which I think had some justification, is that even when Jews are not threatened physically, those who do not live within a sort of ultra-Orthodox ghetto are endangered culturally. And therefore, there is a need to have a Jewish home as a powerhouse for Jewish identity.
I'm talking with Ari Shavit, who is a reporter for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and his new book is called My Promised Land. But Ari, in this book, you talk about the evolution of Zionism, because some of those early 20th century Zionists were what we might think of as political radicals. They had a socialist vision in addition to this vision of saving the culture of their people.
Absolutely. It went together for them. The Zionism, to begin with, was a general movement with all sorts of people joining that division, but in the 20s, 30s, 40s, it became predominantly a socialist movement. So the great dream was a socialist Zionist dream. The kibbutz was the symbol of that, the icon of that. The attempt was not only to build a national home, but to create a just society, egalitarian society, a democrat, if you wish, a really democratic socialist society. In many ways, this succeeded for a generation or two, and Israel was remarkably egalitarian while growing and being a rather free society. But the utopia is now gone. That dream will not materialize. And my claim of the book, in my book, is that while the utopia, the great just society, the unique, is will not be there, the great achievement of Zionism is the creation of an amazingly robust free society that is one of the most lively and vital societies one can imagine. So the fact that this threatened nation that is really existentially endangered to this day, surrounded by dangerous enemies with a tragic past, the fact that this society chose life and celebrates life and is so innovative and creative and sensual and sexy in many ways, this is the unintended success of Zionism. This is not what the dream was about, but this is an amazing success and achievement which I think needs recognition and perhaps even admiration.
As juxtaposed to that, you also write about something that many Israelis don't want to think about, which is the history of the Palestinians from the 20th century to the present, something that you say that your countrymen ignore.
Absolutely. I wouldn't say all my countrymen, but there is... My claim is the following. Because the need to create this home for homeless people was so deep, was so desperate, people like my great-grandfather went there at the end of the 19th century, and many of his peers did not see and would not see that the Palestinians were there. Now, the claim, the anti-Zionist and anti-Israeli claim that they conquered the nation is totally wrong, because the Middle East was in a kind of chaotic situation. There was no Palestine there as a political entity. They did not conquer a land and a nation. But they ignored the existence of the Palestinians. This is where the tragedy is for. If I write about the triumph and the tragedy, the triumph is really this remarkable victory of life, of people that have saved themselves and are so vital. It's like a vitality against all odds project. But the flaw is this 100-year-old conflict that refuses to end. And we see every American Secretary of State going there and trying to end it and hoping that there will be peace by next spring. And somehow it doesn't materialize. I hope this time it succeeds. And the reason is that there is a very deep conflict there. And as I like to say, I'm an anti-occupation guy, but the conflict is not about occupation, and I'm against settlements. The conflict is not only about settlements. It's a deep conflict with religious elements, historic elements, and partly it's a result of the blindness of some of my countrymen and women who would not see the Palestinians, but just the same, the blindness of the Palestinians who would not recognize us as a real people that have real rights in our ancient homeland.
When did you begin to develop this nuanced understanding of what is going on in your country? Do you date it to your time in the service?
I think that during my time in service, I became actually a banal peacenik. I became a leftist, peace activist. I was a human rights activist, something I'm very proud of, and these are my values to this day. I think that later on, about a decade or a decade and a half later, I realized that these noble values that are the values of progressive America, the progressive West, and progressive Israel are in clash with the brutal reality of the conflict and with the brutal reality of the Middle East. Look at what we see in Syria. I mean, just in the last 2 years in Syria, more people were murdered than all the victims of the 100 years of the war between Palestinians and Israelis, much more. So we are trying to maintain democracy and maintain liberal values in a region that is so violent and so it's so saddening to see how brutal the region is. So I developed this nuanced, I moved in a sense from the left to a kind of creative centrism, trying to realizing that while my values are the values that I always upheld, reality does not always correspond to them. And in this sense, I think that my book is relevant to Americans, not only the ones concerned about Israel, because America is faced with this constant contradiction between its democratic values and the harsh realities of the Middle East. And it's no wonder that America ran into so many troubles in recent decades, because I think that you, like me, have a difficulty resolving this conflict between your amazing values and the harsh reality of the region I come from.
This book, as you mentioned, it's a personal look from many different angles. You profile settlers, ultra-religious settlers, zealots, some of them. You profile people from the peace movement. You write about history. And knowing that there's not a monolithic Israeli point of view, how would you describe the average Israeli's attitude towards Palestinians, towards the idea of a two-state solution?
Probably there is no such thing as an average Israeli. I think Israel is deeply divided into, we like to describe it as four, five, six different tribes, some of whom you mentioned. I'm trying to be hopeful, and I hope it's not wishful thinking. I believe it's not wishful thinking. I think that while the real peaceniks are perhaps a minority, and perhaps a minority anywhere, the liberal elite, so to speak, is a minority anywhere, and so is the case in Israel. But I think that those people who have given up on Israel because they think it became ultra-Orthodox or extremist or settler state, I think these people are wrong. Because I think that the extreme forces in Israel that really endanger its democratic structure are a minority. They are even a small minority. And if we work in a wise way with a great Israeli center, with a kind of silent Israeli majority that actually wants Israel to be America. I mean, most Israelis would like a life that people have in Seattle. That's what people want. They do not want great historic nationalist grandeur or religious. They're not religious fanatics. Most Israelis, give them Seattle and they'll settle. They'll make many concessions. So if we'll talk reasonably to these people and we'll offer them a new peace concept that is realistic, that is not detached from the reality that surrounds us, I think we can work out and build a majority that will move for peace in a gradual and cautious manner. If we don't do that, then the darker sides will win. And in my mind, what we need now is a great alliance between non-Tea Party America and non-Tea Party Israel. We have to overcome the alliance between Tea Party America and Tea Party Israel. And if we do that, I think that actually there is a chance to have some good news coming out of that troubled country.
Ari Shavit is a journalist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. His new book is called My Promised Land. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW with Ross Reynolds. I'm Marcy Silman.